Welcome to another episode of We the People Radio.
Easy for you to say.
At least I knew it was a blue heron.
Yeah.
My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff, and our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery. Ta-da. They're our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer, and they've got everything you want when it comes to John Deere. Go up and see them. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard, and they've got a full inventory right now of mowers, Z-mowers, riding mowers, tractors, implements.
What's a Z-mower?
Z-mower, that's one of those mowers that you drive with levers instead of a steering wheel, and they zip around about twice the speed of a regular mower. They're a lot of fun.
Wow.
Yeah, need to go up. Yeah, go up and see them. You can even take a test drive. They'll flip you the keys, and you can drive it around a lot, see how you like it.
Mow the rocks.
Well, yeah, you probably won't be able to turn the mower on.
Turn the mower.
Or give them a call. Their phone number is 530-226-9226, or you can catch them on the web at PapeMachinery.com.
Mm-hmm.
There you are.
There you go.
Yeah.
And, we're getting a thumbs up. Thumbs up from our friend
Liam. That was for me.
Liam in the booth.
Yeah.
He was giving you the mower thumbs up.
Yep. He was giving me the thumbs up.
Hey, and if you're having any issues with the website, our website, by the way, at wethepeopleradio.us, if you have any issues with the color or the ability to read the words or, you know, any of that stuff, because I had to switch it all around, would you email us? That'd make it really, really easy. There's a contact form right there on the page, or it's Erin, E-R-I-N, at wethepeopleradio.us.
Speaking of color, I'm not into the puce you have on the one page there, so.
No, I tried to make it tan, and it just won't do tan. And then when you do it on the phone, it's a different color.
Yeah.
It shows up a different color on the
phone.
Those
are mobile colors.
I got boined on that one.
Yeah.
So anyway, Robert and I are doing a matching effort on the archive site and the regular site. So there's stuff moving around. We're sorry about that. Try to keep it the same as much as we can. But if you have any problems, let us know. Or you see anything funky, let me know. So our guest today is William Walter Kay. I've been thinking we needed to get back to Canada to find out what was going on up there, but then he's talking about Australia, so but maybe we'll still find out what's going on up in Canada. He has earned an English degree in 1982. I think mine was 1985, so we were doing the same thing. But then he did what my dad wanted, and he went to law school, got his law degree in 1985. After practicing law, he went on to establish a small business and nonprofits, and he's written two books. The Green Swastika, Environmentalism in the Third Reich, and From Malthus to My Pristestone. I never get that word right. I don't know what it is. It's a big tongue twister. It's about population control. Let's cut to the chase. It's about population control. We did a really good show with him on population control, too, so if that's a topic that you're wondering about, you hear it a lot, and you think, oh, that's silly, they're not doing that, or you think they're totally doing that, and you'd like to actually have accurate info, scroll down through the shows on today's page. Today would be the 15th of... 15th? Yeah.
It's January
25th.
Yeah.
Or January 15th, 2023. And your computer's wrong. Go to the front page. And he's a producer, appeared in countless radio programs, posted hundreds of articles across dozens of websites, and he's a really outspoken critic of the catastrophic anthropogenic means caused by people, global warming hypothesis, and related policies. He's been doing that for like 35 years. But that was where we first got involved with him was his website was Environmentalism is Fascism, and it's like, oh, I think we like him. We might want to talk to him. And that's, how long ago did we do that? 2011. So we did that within the first year of the show, actually. And we've been chatting about things ever since. So, William, I know you sent me some other new stuff, but then you had the thing about the coal, and we could talk about whatever you want. You got a long list today.
Well, the Australia connection is because I do a regular show for TNT Radio in Brisbane now, and that is definitely coal country, like we don't even have in North America. USA has the largest coal reserves. Australia comes in third, but Australia only has, you know, probably about 8% of the population of the UK, so their coal is just the backbone of their economy. It's their number one export. Before the climate campaign, it was over 80% of their electricity came from coal. and they are facing the same coal phase-out that the USA is. So it is absolutely going to devastate their economy. So there's a lot of pushback there, even though they're suffering the same sort of political paralysis that the rest of us are. But increasingly, I'm just focusing, trying to get people to wrap their brain around the idea that this is actually economic warfare.
Mm-hmm.
That if you're talking about destroying America's coal industry and America's petroleum industry, you're basically taking out both the country's legs. And it is such a massive change to America's economy and America's culture that it is absurd to think that it's merely a byproduct or collateral damage because we're so damned concerned about the sea levels 100 years from now. That doesn't pass the laugh test. The objective of this exercise is taking out America's oil industry and coal industry. That's the aim. And the climate propaganda is simply to facilitate that aim. It is not what is motivating people.
Yeah, and we've seen that it's really, really helping them in Europe, specifically Germany, I guess, comes to mind, to have kind of screwed themselves.
Yeah, they're kind of realizing that maybe that was the wrong road to go down.
Well, this campaign is definitely being orchestrated out of Europe. There's always an effort to sort of blame China or blame other groups for it. But if you know the actual history, of the campaign, this is something that was developed slowly in Europe, really starting in the mid-1970s and really picking up traction in the mid-80s. And the EU views America as a major rival, even though we're sort of allies, we're sort of frenemies. There's been long-running rivalry between the two areas. And I tend to use the term Anglosphere because America, Australia, and Canada are more or less in the same boat. They're countries that possess vast hydrocarbon reserves. They've really got something to lose by the shutdowns and the phase-outs of the coal and oil industry. The EU is not in that position. Not a single EU country. There's 27 countries there. Not a single one is a top 40 oil producer. Not a single one is a top 40 possessor of petroleum reserves. It's an area that's almost unusually devoid of petroleum. And they're importing hundreds upon hundreds of billions of dollars worth of petroleum every year. And it is very much in the long-term survival of the European Union that they phase out petroleum through electromobility, through hydrogen, through biofuels, through renewable energy, what have you. This policy, this energy transition, it makes sense in Europe. It is sound in Europe because it's allowing them to emancipate themselves from a dependency on a commodity which they have none locally.
Mm-hmm.
It does not make any sense in Canada, America, or Australia. Here it is going to have a devastating effect. Here we're knocking out what is our primary competitive advantage, is the possession of these hydrocarbon reserves.
Germany is reopening their coal industry, aren't they?
They're having to. The whole Russian crisis is sort of throwing a spanner in the works. A lot of countries around Europe are having to fire up some of them. There's simply not enough natural gas. They don't want the lights to go out. They're having to do it. But by all accounts, this is temporary. Once they sort of hook up the natural gas, so they're getting more of it from North America and from the Arab world, once they've overcome the sudden break with Russia, they will return to plan A, and that is using natural gas to phase out coal and try to bring in this renewable natural gas thing. It's a big mistake to think that they are abandoning the energy transition. They are not. They have every intention of completely phasing out coal mining in Germany. Poland is supposed to phase out coal mining. They're the only EU country that really depends on it. And it's causing a major friction. I wouldn't be surprised if Poland ends up getting kicked out of the EU for refusing to phase out their coal industry.
Are they talking about doing it or not? I mean, do they realize
Poland?
That they can't do that? Poland? Yeah.
As a tribute to the peer pressure that these COP conventions can have, At one of recent COP convention, the Polish environment minister stood up and committed Poland to a 2030 coal phase-out. And then 1 hour later, after getting just screamed at by Polish prime ministers and presidents and everybody else, she takes the podium again to say that no, that she had misspoke and that the phase-out was for 2049.
Oh.
Which, and then Poland says that it's far enough in the future that they don't even want to think about it. That's what you do. But they say that ultimately they will transition to uranium, to nuclear power. But by the 2049 phase out, like, who cares? Who's thinking 25 years down the road? Nobody. But it's interesting that they're under that pressure, and that is not acceptable to the Germans and to the rest of the European Union, that Poland would remain a primarily coal-fired power country to 2049. That is not acceptable. So there's all kinds of other problems going on there. I wouldn't be surprised. Hate to make predictions, but if Poland just doesn't get the boot right out of it.
So is there any pressure being put on China and India for their use of coal? I mean, they're full steam
absolutely
ahead.
Absolutely none. Absolutely yeah. None. The way that it was structured in 1992, people with great political foresight, like George Bush Sr., signed this document called the United Nations Convention's Framework on Climate Change. And it has a list of countries at the end. They're called the Annex One countries. And they are the only countries who are undertaking economy-wide emission reductions targets and programs. And that is the European Union and the English-speaking countries and Norway and Turkey and Japan. Those are the only ones doing it. Russia, Belarus, and Ukraine, but we can draw red lines through them. They are no longer part of planet Earth. But it comes down to the European Union and Japan and the English-speaking world all agreeing to phase out coal and oil. But if you look at the European Union and Japan, you'll realize they don't have any domestic oil and coal industry. And this is not really going to cause them any damage. Rather, it's going to facilitate their efforts to achieve energy independence and energy security by emancipating their economies from dependence on fossil fuels. We are facilitating their agenda. And a child should see that if you knock out America's oil and coal industry, you know, that's what bombers do during the wars. You know, they attack each other's energy industries. We're seeing it right now in the Ukraine. That is what's happening. There is an economic warfare campaign being conducted against America, and it's destroying its coal industry. It's halfway through destroying its coal industry. And now it's really starting to set its sights on the oil industry, particularly the pipeline industry, stuff like that. But yeah, this is an economic warfare campaign.
Yeah, and in the meantime, you have China, which, you know, they're a developing nation, are exempt from all of this, and as they
not
move...
just China. There's 160 countries that are exempt.
Are they really?
Wow.
The only countries that are not exempt are the EU, Japan, and the English-speaking world. Of those countries, the only that have hydrocarbon industries worth sacrificing are the United States, Australia, and Canada. Britain does as well, but it was the first victim. It's completely yeah. shut down its coal industry, and it is suffering the consequences. It's good you're bringing up the China point, because there's always an effort to say that perhaps China's pulling the strings here. You hear that a lot in the climate skeptical community. I just don't think they have the capacity, the integration into the culture of America and into the political elites of America to, you know, pull off an operation like this. China does not. China is sort of isolated and marginalized. But if you look at the operations of NATO and the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development and the International Energy Agency and the United Nations Environment Program, they all involve top American officials, like ministerial conferences that are going on almost continuously. And at those conferences, they're almost always in Europe, and the Europeans almost always outnumber the Americans 25-1. And this is an ongoing process. But there is no way the People's Republic of China has anywhere near the sort of high-level treetop contact with the ministers and heads of state and heads of government that the European Union does. They have a lot more influence, magnitudes more influence on our government elites than the Chinese do.
Right, But they are taking full advantage of their ability.
Oh, they are.
Yeah, and grow their economy.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yes. This is the timeline. You can find newspaper articles in the 1990s when the Europeans were convinced with the coming solar power revolution that all of those PV panels were going to be manufactured in Europe. Like going into the whole climate caper, Europe was of the view that all of this renewable energy stuff was going to be manufactured domestically. And then I remember seeing an article around the year 2010, and by that time China had 50% of the PV market were being manufactured in China. And now you're seeing numbers like 97%, 98%.
Yeah. Oops.
The Chinese they have their own branch plants now. The Chinese companies are putting factories into Vietnam and other places where they're getting even cheaper labor. Couple of points there.
Hold that thought. Let's not chop it in half. We'll take a quick break, come back with our guest, William Altercay. He is coming to us from Canada, and we're going to talk about, the energy stuff today. How about that? So here's a little salute to regular people.
Homemade sandwich, a half a jug of tea. Average Joe, average pay. Same old end, the same old day. But there's nothing wrong with a hard hat and a hammer. Kind of glue that sticks this world together. Hands of steel and cradle of the promised land. God bless the working man.
Be ashamed of the car I drive. I'm just glad to be here, happy to feel that. It don't matter if you're by my side. I'm satisfied. Well, it's all.
Long way to get to the last line. It's a snappy tune. I tell you, it does feel like we're going to the end of the line, though. There's something eerie about that. Go back to your two points there before we so rudely cut you off.
That's okay. I'm just trying. Oh yeah, 2 points about the fact that China and countries in that vicinity have completely taken over the PV manufacturing market. One, excellent article showing that China, those manufacturing facilities are powered by coal-fired power plants. They're paying 4 cents a kilowatt hour. You couldn't manufacture solar panels using solar power electricity. They would be so expensive no one would be able to afford them. And the same goes for the labor costs. Like this fantasy that the Europeans were having, they were going to be the workshop of the world for solar panels in the 90s. That was, could you imagine union labor and renewable energy for electricity? No, nobody could afford solar
panels. Nobody could afford them.
It's only
right.
With the super cheap labor and the super coal-fired electricity.
Were they ever even, like, on the field? Were they ever players? Or did it just blow right by him? I wasn't paying attention to that in the
90s. I remember reading it was from the 90s. It was profiling this rising German business star, and he was sort of the solar king of Germany, and he had all these PV manufacturing facilities in Germany. But I think that he's either bankrupt or he's moved the whole operation to the Orient, most likely.
Hmm.
No, they got totally whacked out of that market, and the same thing is now happening to them in the wind turbine market. You know, the Chinese, it's taken this long. All of that R&D that the Germans and the Danes, like the billions upon billions of dollars of R&D, they keep pouring into wind turbines. The Chinese are just appropriating that for free. And they are now squeezing out the Germans from a lot of these international offshore deals. Like, once again, the Germans and the Danes thought that this is another industry that they would dominate, not just domestically, but as the developing world converts to wind power, they would be getting the contracts for the turbines. And now they're losing that industry as well to China. But this was an unintended consequence. This is something that is happening now for a program that was adopted by European governments almost 50 years ago, like 48 years ago. And they had no idea where it was going to go. A lot of the technology, these giant coastal offshore wind turbines, no one had any vision that these things would exist. Same goes with electric vehicles. They when they first launched on the petroleum phase out in Europe in 1974, they thought the future was the hydrogen car, the solar cell. They still believed in that, and biofuels and things like that. They didn't have that much space in the electric vehicle, and it really wasn't until the late 80s, early 90s, which is like 15 years later, that they started to realize the potential of wind turbines. This program, this is now its 48th, 49th anniversary of this program.
Yeah, and here we are. We're now using this technology to our deficit. I mean, it doesn't.
Let's
pay
burn
for
everything
itself.
Down and use something magical.
Yeah, it just
we're all going to ride unicorns.
Feasible.
Yeah,
I wrote a pocket or article called "Aussies Go 100% Coal," and just to visualize. See, the real tragedy is people are not researching just how advanced modern steam turbine technology is, like how advanced these modern nuclear power plants and coal-fired power plants can get. It isn't, though, that's not static technology either. General Electric now produces a 1900 megawatt steam turbine.
Wow.
Your standard sort of wind turbine on land is 1 or 2 megawatts. This thing will produce 1900 times that.
Wow.
GE's largest offshore turbine, wind turbine, has 10 times the steel that their 1,900 megawatt turbine has in it. I mean, there's far more efficient turbines and electrical advancements going on in the nuclear industry and in the coal industry, and they're happening around the world. Places like China and Vietnam are building a lot of coal-fired power plants. So is South Korea. South Korea's got a power station now that produces over 6,000 megawatts. You would literally have to have, you know, probably 40,000 turbines to equal the amount of electricity they can produce. And the turbines are built by Toshiba's, and they're all over 1,000 megawatts. That's the future. This is going on now, but there's great advances being made in sort of creating power stations where you have very long arrays of turbines and making those turbines a lot larger. And they will be producing electricity so much more cheaply and reliably than this renewable bunk.
What do you,
and it's a travesty. Go ahead.
What do you think the future, we're starting to hear about this fusion advancements. Do you think that's anything that's in our near future?
I have not researched that enough. I've always been more interested in those breeder reactors. There are other technologies that are coming forward. I really can't comment on the fusion. It seems always kind of space age, and they always say that it's so far in the future. But there's other things they can do. There's the new supercritical plants. They've got both the nuclear and the coal plants have got these facilities where they hold the water, the steam, in these super high pressure chambers, and they crank up the heat, you know, to probably, you know, 500-600 Fahrenheit, and they can hold it in that and release it in a timed fashion, and they get a lot more bang for the buck in terms of the amount of fuel. Like, they're doubling the amount of fuel with that technology. And some of those breeder reactors, the ones that, it's sort of like a Pong thing, because the byproduct of one reactor is plutonium, and it is used in the other reactor, and its byproduct is uranium-235. It's not a perpetual motion machine, But you can, if you set up these two reactors side by side, you can get a lot more bang for the buck out of the uranium ore. They canceled that because the price of uranium fell so much. But there's a lot they could be doing with those technologies. The tragedy is we're pouring hundreds of billions of dollars into research and development and building solar and biofuels and wind. The tragedy is that money could have been shunted and should be shunted towards the real technologies that work, like nuclear and coal and large dam hydro, things like that. We're being saddled with this expensive intermittent electricity. It's going to completely undermine the competitiveness of the American economy.
Well, I think nuclear has gotten such a bad rap in the last 20 or 30 years. I doubt if we're ever going to see a new nuclear plant being built in this country. There's just too much resistance to it.
Well, it's going to take a political revolution. But, yeah, I'm confident because I'm really liking the 118th Congress. I posted an article about that on Canada Free Press. It was on their cover. Over 80% of this Congress are climate science rejectors. They're doubters. I don't like to call them deniers, but these are people who are seeing through it. They are 80% of them. So there's a real collision happening, and it's going to impact not just coal and oil, but also nuclear. Like a really rethink of this. We have to, not just Americans, but Americans, Australians, Canadians have to rethink energy policy without the environmentalists in the room. We have to rethink fuel policy without the climate alarmists in the room. They must be purged from the room. We're going to have this conversation about how we're going to make electricity and how we're going to fire up our vehicles without these crackpots going on about carbon dioxide and sea levels in Vanunu. That is what has to happen.
And don't forget polar bears that we have lots of, but we're still talking about them.
There's too many polar bears.
Right, but we're still talking about them, which is amazing.
Ship them to Europe.
Yeah, the oceans turning to acid, that's one of my favorites.
I love that one.
Yeah.
Bleaching the coral that's actually white to start with.
Yeah. When they launched the climate change campaign, 1984, 1985, it was not as though it was something really weird at the time. You've already mentioned nuclear. Yeah, they created this huge phobia about radioactivity, about radio fallout. It was a wild exaggeration of the potential dangers. And they traveled the country lying about how much cancer was happening around nuclear power plants, and they mobilized this nuclear freeze movement, and they spiked the American nuclear industry. And that was being done at the same time. While that was happening, France was getting 90% of its electricity from nuclear. It's still 75%. Read an excellent sociology essay comparing Germany with France. And it's funny how one country can have this massive anti-nuclear movement, and across the border, there's zero anti-nuclear movement. That was interesting. But I think that, we're going to open all this up. This is all going to be opened up. I'm very confident that the momentum with this Congress, who knows? But they are going to really start rethinking a lot of the environmental restrictions that went down. Sorry, I got off topic there. When they launched the climate change campaign, it wasn't just global warming. They had already had a global cooling scare, and there was the nuclear fallout scare. There was a mercury poisoning scare. There was an acid rain scare. There was a desertification scare. They were all circulating in the mass media at the same time. So when there was a G7 meeting in London in 1984, Margaret Thatcher introduces climate change as an option. Her country has already committed herself to a coal phase-out due to just the labor strife with the coal industry. But they had committed themselves to a coal phase-out, and she is proposing climate change as an overarching rationale for both the petroleum and the coal phase-outs. And the assembled heads of government there, including Ronald Reagan, signed off on this. Although with Reagan and Bush Sr., they know that this isn't going to come to anything in the next 15, 20 years, and they were right. Like, it took a long time for this thing to really get pulled together. But after that G7 meeting, all the heads of government undertook to dispatch their environment ministers to write climate change synopsis threat assessments. And at the next G7 meeting in Bonn, they kicked off the climate crusade because they were all so convinced that we were, you know, at death's door in terms of a climate catastrophe. And within a few years, they had assembled the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and then a few years later, we have the Rio Summit and the United Nations Convention Framework Change. But it's those years, 84 to 92, were the critical years, where this movement went from just talk, just propaganda, into being an on-the-ground, tractioned movement that was receiving billions of dollars from several major governments. That was the transition that happened from 1984 to 1992. Prior to that, from 74 to 84, you have the beginnings of the petroleum phase-out. It starts with the Arab oil embargo, which terrifies Europe. They then launch campaigns to phase out petroleum in 1974. And they were campaigning to phase out petroleum for a decade before they rebranded the campaign climate change. And they fused it with the coal phase-out campaign. But it is really has everything to do. Like, you know, you have too many commentators are always trying to look around behind the elephant in the room. They think, well, this climate change campaign is a way to sort of change the whole society. No, it's a way to destroy your energy industry. That's doing enough damage. Don't worry about the other side effects of this. Go ahead.
Oh no! I was just thinking about how this whole thing started and how we've created celebrities or people with celebrity status now because they're these great climate change alarmists, and so much of it, if not all of it, is just bunk. And we can't seem to put enough people up front to prove that this information is fallacy.
Well, you just get called a heretic and then the game's over.
Yeah,
precisely. You are contradicting the authorities,
right?
And that is something that some people actually psychologically cannot do, it appears. I don't know how many...
They're still wearing masks.
How often have you had that argument? Like, you ever seen that one? She comes on CNN. I don't watch news, but I watch some of her clips on the Internet. S.E. Cup.
Yes.
She is one of the broadcasters on CNN, one of the vignette makers there. Several times she's broached the climate change issue. And she only has one argument. She just moves through the authorities. She goes, well, the EPA says it's a problem. And NASA says it's a problem, so it's a problem. Like the idea that the authorities could be wrong,
right.
Incomprehensible. Just incomprehensible.
Yeah, nobody does their own research. They just mimic everything that's been said in the past, and they just keep repeating it, and pretty soon people figure, well, it must be true.
Well, yeah.
Well, what was key was the capturing of scientific institutions in America.
Yeah.
In the 100th Congress. That was 1988 to 1990. George Bush Sr.'s president, both houses of Congress, solidly Democratic majority. They launched this thing called the U.S. Global Change Research Program. And its current budget is $5.5 billion at least. It's kind of hard to figure it out because it's an amalgamation of 13 different agencies, including the National Office of Oceans and Atmosphere and the EPA and NASA and the National Science Foundation. And each of these organizations have been commandeered to pump out climate propaganda. And that sort of umbrella group, the U.S. Global Change Research Program, puts out these national climate assessments periodically, and it's complete global warming bunk. But I'm looking at the budgets of the National Science Foundation, and I'm realizing what they call climate-themed funding is $2.5 billion. No, $1.5 billion And about half of that they give over to this other umbrella agency. NASA, as current budget, is getting $2.4 billion to address the climate crisis. And I'm moving around these
blocks. They say that all the time, address the climate crisis. The other part of it, too, is that if anybody wants to participate and have any type of funding options through the government, you have to have that lingo in your program. So if you're just... You have to incorporate that, otherwise you're kind of persona non grata.
Yeah, and it all starts with the assumption that there is climate change.
Right.
Nobody's
studying if it's real or not.
Right.
It's only about proving it. We have to take a really quick break.
Your definition. Okay, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, we got to take a really quick break, and we'll come right back. Talk about it some more.
All my friends, we're all misunderstood. They say we stand for nothing, and there's no way we ever could. Now we see everything that's going wrong with the world and those who lead it. We just feel like we don't have the means to rise above and beat it. So we keep waiting, waiting, waiting on the world to change. We keep on waiting, waiting, waiting on the world to change.
I can see by your eyes you must be lying. Thing I don't have a clue. Baby, you're crazy. If you think that you can fool me, because I've seen that movie too.
We have seen that movie, too, haven't we?
Yeah, we've seen that movie. I've seen that movie in reruns.
But once I did the international panel, the IPCC guys, once they showed up, then that seemed to be really a stark point.
That was 1988.
Was it really?
So that would have been 3 years after the 85 G7 summit when they... more or less consents that this was going to be a major crusade. It still took them a couple of years to assemble that. It is a crucial organization. It centralizes the scientists, mainly once again from the EU countries and from the English-speaking world, but they pull together what appears to be the authoritative statement. And in each instance, it's the leading government-funded science academies that are signing off on this. And that's what I was getting at. Right now the U.S. taxpayer is spending $10 billion a year to propagandize themselves with this climate science propaganda. The reason why so many people believe that climate science, the global warming hypothesis, that the catastrophic human-induced global warming hypothesis is true, is because NASA says it's true, it's because the NOAA says it's true, etc. It's because the National Science Foundation says it's true. And it was the capturing of these institutions with an absolute river of money that created that. And most people can't. The idea that if you would suggest to an SE cup that, a huge amount of government funding has absolutely corrupted climatology, it has absolutely corrupted atmospheric physics. And then those clowns would be janitors if they weren't preaching climate propaganda like that. And if you are not about to preach climate alarmist propaganda, you are not going to get any grant money. These people understand fully what they are doing, and they understand fully that it is a cultural war.
Yeah, I can't believe that. People look at the amount of money that's given to different agencies, different foundations, different states. I mean, all this federal money they could spread around, and they all scream about it, that it's influencing, whatever their subject is. But then when it comes to climate change, they spread this money around, and that's different. That doesn't have any effect on the outcome.
No, they're not marginalizing the scientists who disagree with them, which is how you usually do science. You have you have a robust debate. We stopped having robust debate quite a while ago.
But William's right. All the money that they give them, that influences, and nobody talks about that.
No, it is absolutely censored information. I'm just looking at the National Oceans and Atmosphere Agency, this year's budget. They've got a big budget, but within the budget, their climate budget is $256 million. That is their climate change propaganda budget. You know, and to real mortals, like $256 million, that is an absolutely enormous amount of money.
Sure it is.
Yeah.
I mean, if you want a howl, go to the NOAA. They are part of the Department of Commerce, actually. But if you go to their website, they've got a climate program grant funding opportunities. And there's right now probably 300-400 grants that are available between the $50,000 and $300,000 market. If you're a scientist, you can apply for them. They're just handing them out like candy.
Hmm.
And that has a dramatic influence. It's like, you know, it's like feeding time at the zoo sort of thing.
Wow. And we've
and
spoken.
Every one of those organizations, like NASA, is spending a lot more money doing it. But it's just the name of the game is you come up with scientific research that validates the climate alarmist model. They are not at all interested in someone coming up with things that poke holes in it.
Oh, they wouldn't get any money?
Zero. It's a propaganda machine. Now, the good news is huge numbers of Americans are aware of this. But the real bridge is now that you control Congress, the real contradiction is why doesn't the Republican-controlled Congress cut the funding off for this crap? Because it is so obviously nothing more than a scientific guise over top of an economic warfare stratagem, and your government is paying for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, they pay for
Congress.
I'm pretty sure the Senate and the President wouldn't sign any legislation of that kind.
Well, so. the Congress controls the money.
They don't control it to the end, though. All money.
They say, we are not paying for this. We are not paying for this.
Yeah, but all spending starts in the House. It just doesn't end there. They're not the start and stop. They're just the beginning. So, I mean, anything that has that in it, any cuts for that, I guarantee you the President isn't signing and the Senate isn't passing. Unfortunately.
Well, I don't know.
At this point.
It's a constitutional law argument, but it seems to give Congress control of the purse strings.
No, just the House. Congress is the House and the Senate.
House. I'm talking about the House of Representatives.
Yeah. So they
we're not paying for this, period.
Yeah. Yeah, unfortunately, it's not as unilateral as it sounds.
What happens is people crumble. That's what happens.
Sure.
But I don't know. Though I'm looking at it, they have the authority to pull the plug on this crap.
Oh, they can definitely bring it to the attention of the American people and vote to cut the funding. But then when it goes to the Senate, you got the Fruit Loops over there that are going to say, we're not going to pass this.
The Senate can't generate funding for something that hasn't been approved by the House of Representatives.
Oh, true. They can't generate it,
but it's a negotiated bill.
The House of Representatives just sits there with their arms crossed and say, no, we're not funding this.
Yeah.
I know. Anyways, this is the constitutional argument. I could be wrong, but I think it's a political will thing. If you've got a majority in the House of Representatives, just absolutely refuse to pay for some of this stuff. It would cause a crisis. You're right about that.
Yeah. Well,
oh, yeah, and I think a lot of these politicians would really have to stand back and take a hard look at what they're voting to do and not do, because let's face it, they have to get reelected. And when the people realize that this money is going to these causes that are total bunk, and you have representatives and senators that are voting for it,
That's how you
change. You get rid of them, and you put people in there that understand it.
That people are not sure because the information isn't really there.
Oh, they've been browbeat with it for the last 30 years, and so it's got to be true. You know,
it's coming from their own government. They're using the immature.
Yeah.
They're using the symbolism of the National Science Academy and of NASA and things like that. And it's kind of hard to argue against it. Like, all SE Cup is doing is saying, NASA agrees with me and the National Science Academy agrees with me, and that's the end of the argument. Bye.
Yep.
Well, we've interviewed scientists who had really good data on the other side who were excommunicated from the scientific community for raising those issues and had their funding cut. I can't remember his name, but he was a professor at UCLA and wound up crossways with these guys. And the retribution is swift and dire.
It is true, and I could probably cull from my memories 40 or 50 stories like that. There was a book called The Deniers, bad title, but it was a profiling about a dozen leading academics. Some of them, the ones who speak openly are the ones who are about to retire. Quite often they say things like, I wouldn't dare say this if I wasn't about to retire.
Right.
But, you know, there was the former head of the Italian National Science Foundation, named Zinni, outspoken critic of the catastrophic global warming hypothesis, as are, like, you know, the list of, like, just the most high-profile scientists you can imagine. Like, one of the excellent book written by Dr. Ian Palmer of Australia called Heaven and Earth, best book I've read on climate change, and he's twice won the Australia's top science award, and he is a geologist, and he is someone who just rakes the theory over the coals. And there literally are dozens of just very high-profile scientists who you are never going to hear from in the mainstream media. And more often than not, these guys are so close to retirement or so deeply tenured or so well respected that they can get away with it. But the up and coming young bucks who are all working on 1-year contracts, you know, Joe scientist ain't paid to think down there. You better believe it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Once we put so much money in it, you look at just little things. I look at little things that happen just in our local communities. You guys probably have that up there too, where, you know, they're going to do a project. They have to somehow tie it to the climate thing. Otherwise, there's no funding. Do you have that same problem in Canada?
Yeah, I wonder how much of that goes on. Oh, yeah. I've been doing research about this U.S. Global change budget, because a lot of these bureaucracies are notorious for doing that. Like, for one thing, they're always creating a new umbrella bureaucracy to oversee what all these other bureaucracies are doing. And the other bureaucracies under the umbrella are each committing some of their resources to the project, but it's not entirely clear whether they're actually changing what they were originally planning to do, or are they just changing the names of what they're doing. That goes on a lot. For better or for worse. But, yeah, it's, in terms of academic funding, I've heard that story multiple times, that try to incorporate climate change into whatever your grant proposal is, if you want them to, you want anyone to notice it. That's sort of the quasi, you know, sort of totalitarian world we're getting into now. And that's how important this energy transition is to the people who are pushing the energy transition. This is an existential threat to them. If we do not phase out fossil fuels, they believe that, you know, certainly the Europeans believe that Europe is actually doomed. If we remain locked into a fossil fuel-driven plan for the next 2 centuries, Europe will become an economic basket case. It will become an economic backwater. It will be a tourist trap and nothing else.
And why do they think that?
Because they are spending $500 billion a year. They are hemorrhaging huge amounts of money, and they're giving it to their enemies, the Americans, the Russians, the Arabs. This can't go on forever. They have to build their way into energy independence. And even then, if the rest of the world, particularly the Anglosphere, Canada, Australia, and the USA, if they remain on fossil fuel track, they will continue to boom and expand. And they will ultimately just dwarf and actually consume through migration a lot of the European countries. So they view themselves on a downbound train as long as they're trapped in a fossil fuel economy. And they're also, there's a deep, almost religious environmentalism that you get in Europe that you do not get anywhere else. Google the phrase. Go ahead.
Do you see any of the EU leaders kind of looking the other way or looking away from this whole climate nonsense and trying to get back or is this kind of set in stone? This is their path, and they're not going to deviate.
The latter is true, because they are not operating against the interests of their economic elites by any means.
Right.
An article I wrote called "The Rise of the Climate Oligarchs."
Hang on to that thought, and we're going to come back. We're going to talk to you on the flip side for the next hour. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
It's a